Satanic International Network. You're listening to the news.
Upon decaying every foul wicked spirit in the host, the news.
20 minutes, that Gorilla Bay, on the news, right now.
On the news, it's gonna fucking rock. Be there.
The whole point.
To really happen to have a serial crime
necessitates a certain fortitude.
Now onto our show.
All right, it's Sunday night, and you're listening to the Outbreak Edition of The Ooze with your hosts, T.C. Downey and Jason Sorrell. T.C., what's going on, man?
Another wonderful day in fucking scorching hot, sunny fucking Florida. How the hell are you, man?
Doing good. I hear you about the heat. We've been enjoying kind of 90 degrees, 92 degrees for the last 4 or 5 days, and kicked back up to 102 today. So I'm waiting for the end of summer, really, the end of the heat.
Right.
Especially with the fires going on here and everything. But yeah. So.
Even the cactus are begging for a drink of water, eh?
Right. Yeah, this it sucks, man. I left Indiana to get away from the snow, but I didn't know that, you know, I was going to have to deal with shit burning down around me, you know?
Right on. So, been kind of a quiet week in some aspects. Yesterday, though, we did have an incredible show. Yesterday morning, Jason King joined me, and we kind of kicked off a discussion on the, the second century, the early days of Christianity. I thought it turned out pretty well. Enough that I'm actually going to ask King if he wants to do a part two, because at the end of it, we kind of touched on something that seemed like it needed to be fleshed out. So hopefully sometime in the near future, that'll be a thing.
Right on. That'll be very cool.
Right on. So, what about you? You've been busy as a motherfucker, I'm assuming.
Yeah, I don't know how busy I've been. I mean, like last night we went to a burlesque show. Myself, a friend of mine, Tim, and Entropic Momentum, we're all taking in a burlesque show at a new tavern. And I've been, you know, blogging a little bit about that, doing my Austin lowbrow thing. Doing stuff like that. I've been working on a new book, and that's coming along. It's amazing how fast you can write something when you're taking the position of somebody who's completely insane discussing a topic. So it's an opportunity for me to take a lot of energy and a lot of information that I have on conspiracy theories and different, you know, theories in magic and philosophy and everything else, and express them in an unusual way, you know, almost a schizophrenic kind of, you know, expression of these things, tying things together that might not necessarily be tied together normally. So that's turned out to be a lot of fun, and it's going very quickly.
What's the web address for that?
The web address? Oh, man, I don't know. You'd ask me that. let's see.
Oh, it's got to be Jason's. It always starts with Jason's, so.
It might be Sorrell's. I bet it's Sorrell's Cult of Cthulhu.
Yep, that is. That's it.
Okay. Sorrell's Cult of Cthulhu, and what I'm doing with this blog, first of all, for those listening and everything else, given the history we've had, I want everybody to know right now, up front, this is actually something that was inspired by what we did, our time in the Cult of Cthulhu. So it's inspired by the symbolism. It's inspired a lot by the philosophy and everything else. But this is not about the actual Cult of Cthulhu, the Cult of Cthulhu everybody's familiar with. This is about maybe what I'm doing is a fictional exploration of the Cults of Cthulhu per Lovecraft and other authors, kind of as if, you know, it was actually being implemented in that sense. So I'm talking about, you know, generational families of cultists. You know, they don't call themselves even the Cult of Cthulhu, But throughout history, generational families that have ties to, you know, Cthulhu worship, different ways people are called, treating Lovecraft's writing as, you know, not as necessarily fiction, but as inspired by the dead but dreaming god, incorporating things with, you know, Aleister Crowley. I'm pointing to H.R. Geiger as somebody who's influenced by Cthulhu and the dreamscapes that he's created. The artwork he creates is reflective of the dreams of Cthulhu, and but also it's an opportunity to for me to express, you know, organizational structures. I'm borrowing a lot from you know, old witch cults and things like that, to try and trying to make this book as meaty as possible. So if anything, I'm more inspired by there's a Donald Tyson's Necronomicon series. More inspired by what was going on there than anything in reality. But if you check out the blog, it's just for full disclosure. I even expressed that on the blog that the book is meant to be, you know, it's not tied to that, the actual cult of Cthulhu. And I don't want anybody to, you know, to think they're going to go there and see a bunch of dirt or anything else on the cult of Cthulhu, because it's not. This is just a work of fiction, and doesn't have anything remotely, you know, going on with that other than using that same symbol set, the Cthulhu symbol set.
Right.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, man, before we really go ahead and kick into things tonight, I wanted to kind of just, I guess yesterday morning, there was an error here in the chat inside of the switchboard here. Wasn't showing anybody actually in the chat room, but there were a few participants that were there. And I guess some mediocre drama kind of broke out. And I just wanted to give warning to anybody thinking about popping in here and creating some kind of drama. This is my house, and I will quickly eject you if I find you. So I just wanted to say that.
Right on. Right on. I guess continuing on with the whole the blog. The blog is basically, I wanted to, you know, do the writing process publicly. So I wanted people to see, you know, what I was writing as I was writing it. So there's a bunch of different chapter headings, each of these blog posts. Some of the stuff has things in it. Some of the stuff has nothing in it. Some of it's just a real quick note, you know, on what that subject, what I'm thinking about at that point. And some of it's really filled out and built up. So yeah, check that out and leave your comments so that, you know, I know whether or not it's you think it's a fair workup or not, but do please excuse the grammatical errors and the spelling errors, because it's all, you know, I'm typing away as fast as I possibly can and not doing any of the, spell check or anything like that.
Right on, right on. Well, I've definitely enjoyed everything that I've read it on it so far. I've been checking it out once every other day or so just to see what new comes up. So,
right on, man.
Anyway, I'm with the show, I guess. I know our theme is take action, but what direction are we going tonight, man?
I think that what we should start talking about, we're going to be all over the place tonight, I'm sure, because there's a bunch of different things that we could discuss. We've already talked about, you know, the idea of, you know, beginning to get prepared, beginning to disengage from the system. And I find it interesting that on another blog, on Eminent Mind, I talked about an exit strategy. And it's interesting now. I mean, when you use a phrase, I'm sure that when I use a phrase like ASIC strategy, first of all, it's a common phrase, but then to see it being used by other people in other ways, you just become more aware of it. So I don't know if I'm just picking up something from, you know, from what's already being expressed out there, or if, and this is coming from people who are familiar with this. So that's why I find it's interesting, is that people that I didn't notice using this phrase before are now beginning to use it. So, but with the exit strategy, we're talking about, you know, taking certain actions so you can kind of leverage a wedge between yourself and the system. Start, you know, buffering yourself and limiting your dependence on the system of, you know, the ball system, the economic system, the political system, that kinds of things. I think I wanted to talk about an idea that you've been discussing, this idea of clans. And I know you kind of started to introduce that on Eminent Mind. But it's something that it was even a topic last night at the burlesque show. So there's, you know, there's chicks on stage, scantily clad, shaking their tits and everything else, and me and the guys are talking about, you know, what might happen, what might be coming down the road. So I think we should, I'd like to kind of explore that for a little while and see where that goes and see what the folks in the chat room think. So if you're, while we're talking about this stuff, if you've listened to the other shows or if you're, you're interested in what we're talking about tonight, you want to call in and comment, the number is 347-989-1371. We'd love to have your calls. So, what's your explanation of class? What's your thinking for this, this concept?
Well, it's kind of, I don't know, it's difficult in a way for me to kind of express the entire idea in a general blanket sentiment. But, you know, some time ago, a long, long time ago, people's strengths were drawn from the fact that they had their community at their back. They lived and existed first amongst their family. And then beyond their family, their community. I mean, this kind of tribalism is, in my opinion, one of the key things that perpetuated the modern world today. The problem is, like so many things that happen automatically, we went too far. You know, we got to this idea where, oh, we can exist as a state, and then we can exist as a country, And to come to that point, what has happened is in an effort for everybody to get their own fair shake, certain people have, you know, found weaknesses and exploited that system to work kind of against them. And what I've been discussing with the idea of clan is to group yourself with people of a like mind or people who have a similar drive. And through that, you build kind of this idea of, I don't know, a bond in brotherhood. I was always, as a child, fascinated with blood oaths. I've only ever taken one in my entire life, and that friend passed away there shortly after. It's still the idea of blood oath is something that has always resonated with me heavily. I've always kind of liked the idea that, you know, right, wrong, or indifferent, I would, you know, have somebody at my back. And, you know, I offer the same thing to people that are, you know, loyal as friends or show themselves worthy to me of that kind of friendship from me. It's something that I really have just always kind of sought out. So I guess that's the beginning idea of the clan.
Right on, right on. And I took it, you know, from what you were discussing, I really took it as the idea of, first of all, you're networking with people that share in your ideology. And it's built on that old, you know, that old Celtic idea of clans, as you had mentioned, that old, it's not just Celtic, but a number of cultures where, and what I think is going on here, what I think has changed in our identity with community and everything, is that it used to be when you, that identifier, that you belong to this family, and you that family belonged to this community, it meant something. It had some actual inherent value, that identity. Whereas today, that identity lacks that inherent value. The fact that you live in a certain town and live in a certain neighborhood and what have you does not mean that you can count on your neighbors or what have you to actually give a damn about who you are and what you've got going on.
Right.
Where people had a vested interest in what was going on with each other because that was what was necessary for survival.
In fact, I think that what you might actually find nowadays is that the people that you surround yourself with typically are smiling at you with a knife tucked behind their back. You know, it's just not the same way that it used to be. This idea of belonging to a group of people, and it gave a sense of purpose to you in a way, a sense of, I don't really want to use the term fate, but function rather, you know, you knew what you had to do, and you knew that people depended upon you, and because those were predominant in your mind, people often excelled beyond in an effort to take care of theirs and their own. You know, Sun Tzu talked a lot in On the Art of War about how if you backed your army up into a corner, you know, when there was no place to turn and there was this fierce army coming at you, that people would rise above and become 10 times the warrior that they were prior to walking into that particular war. So it's the same kind of idea when you know that your actions are desperately dependent, not only for you, but for other people who are trusting you. You tend to want to reach the highest mark, if that makes sense.
Right on. Right. Well, I think it's a big part of it. This identity of, you know, belonging to this or having some purpose in this unit, whether you call it a community or whether you call it a family or what have you, something that has been robbed from us through the pursuit of individualism, through the pursuit of, you know, the system telling you that it's either you depend on that system and your government and those policies and those programs around you, and you develop this sense of entitlement. I think it's what's lacking. And the model that we're talking about is a sense of entitlement. The sense is actually in this community or this kind of model is that if you're not pulling your own weight, if you're not doing what you need to do, not only will you not have the things you need, will you not be able to succeed, but then there's a good chance that people you care about, people that you are invested in, whether it's emotionally, intellectually, or what have you, also will not succeed. They'll fail. So whatever it is you did, from the smallest task to the biggest task, whatever it is you did, you wanted to pursue with as much gusto and to try to do as well as possible so that you created the greatest opportunity for success. And this only works, again, with small units. So it means a change in our value structures, the change in the way we do things. And there was a progressive utilization theory developed by Prabhat Rajan Sarkar. He's an Indian philosopher and spiritual leader. He develops a social system. I'm going to put a link to it from the Wikipedia page, and I sent you this link that kind of talks about this. And at the basis of this economic structure is a return to these small units, these small groups of people who are invested in one another, and sharing their resources. And, well, you know, every individual has to pull their own weight. Every individual has to be able to see their own needs. But then the collective as a whole is better able to do so, better able to defend themselves from, you know, outside forces, of course. But then they are, you know, they're more guided by, you know, their own local politics, their own local whatever it is they need, and not so much, you know, hampered by the larger scene, basically, what might be going on in, you know, in state politics or federal politics. Because it doesn't impact them, it doesn't really matter, and how it builds up with, you know, the centralized government having very little actually to do with what goes on with you and your neighbors and what have you in your community. That you have a direct hand in in what you're doing, so there's more self-determination available.
Yeah, it's certainly one option of reclaiming something that we've been missing for quite a long time. I mean, one of the most interesting facets of my discussion with people, or the just discussions in general that I've overheard, is that most people today feel isolated. After you go through the glory of high school, you know, your interconnection and your social activity tends to really dwindle down to a point. You may live next to somebody for 25 years and never actually know anything about your neighbor other than his general profile and his name. Maybe a little bit of information in terms of what he works or whatever, but, you know, there's no deeper understanding. There's no real relationship developed with the person. And I just don't see that as being beneficial to any one person to be that isolated.
Well, I think the key here, too, is that the majority of us wouldn't want to know our neighbors. So let's be perfectly honest. The majority of the people that live around us, we don't really want to have any association with. We have nothing in common. the isolation that I think we're experiencing is not just, you know, not just intellectuals, it's not just Satanists, it's every group of people. It seems like there's been a systematic dispersal, whether it's for the sake of diversity or what have you. There's been a systematic dispersal of peoples so that you don't find yourselves in like-minded communities anymore. You don't actually have the opportunity to find out what everybody's about, to find out what people's philosophies are, to find out what people's goals are, so that you can naturally gravitate towards people who have similar ideas and similar goals, which is what I think would be the beginnings of the stage two of this exit strategy that that we're developing. The idea that, you know, you start networking people. This is something that's going on now. So it's not new. It's not, you know, revolutionary in this thought process. And it's something we've discussed in other forums and everything else, where you start, you know, actually talking to people and finding out what they're about, finding out, you know, first of all, are they pulling their own weight? Do they have, you know, ambition? Do they have goals? And are they willing to pursue those goals? Are they doing for themselves? And then if they share in, you know, they have similar ideologies to you, they are in that same process, in that same mode of thought as you are, then you consider, you know, shared resources. You consider, you know, mutual goals, you know, working towards a common end, that kind of thing. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a community that's living side by side at this point. You're just building and developing those networks, getting those people, you know, lined up. You know, the discussion is occurring, that kind of thing. Down the road, and I know we've put out some different time scales out there, but down the road, it would be one way or the other interesting to see what would happen if a group of like-minded people, a group of people who are invested in one another's mutual benefit, who are voluntarily pursuing these mutual goals and everything else, what would happen if they were to select some small town, wherever Americana, and begin moving to that place, begin actually, you know, going there, getting jobs, you know, kind of like immigration from another country to the United States. One family goes in, they hunker down, they get jobs, they get involved in the system, they find out everything they need to do, and they become the anchor. And then another family moves in, and another family moves in, another individuals move in, all having this like-minded ideology, all having the focus on, you know, we're part of an internal structure, an internal unit within the larger whole, until eventually you become that neighborhood now is of all these neighbors who are like-minded. Well, unlike today, you know, I don't want to associate necessarily with the neighbors in my, you know, in my apartment building. You know, I don't know who they are, and from what I've seen of them, I don't care to know most of them. But having, you know, people that I am interested in could make things much simpler for me, could make my life a little bit easier for me, because just, you know, knowing that the people that I have around me that I can count on for certain things, that I can understand what's going on with them, and if something were to happen where, you know, it affects everyone, well, I could expect a number of those people to actually pull through and look out for my best interests just as I would theirs. I could be invested in them as they are invested in me.
Right on, man. You know, it's interesting. I went through a little bit of an experience in my life. In 2004, Hurricane Charley smacked into the area that I was living pretty hard. And what happened, all the power was knocked out, streets were flooded, trees were down, houses were destroyed. It was obvious that it was going to be, you know, at least a week or so before we got all of that stuff back or began to rebuild. Just in my apartment building, and more specifically, just on the one section on the top floor, I had two neighbors beside myself, so over time, we had all kind of become friends. During this whole thing that happened, you know, we had to kind of pull together, and, you know, we had to cook off all the food that was in our freezers as quickly as I could, and make sure that it would all be storable for later, if that makes sense to you, and eat what would perish right away. And from there, it kind of, I don't know why they decided to do so, but they decided to kind of look to me for guidance as far as what we were to do to continue to, you know, secure ourselves for these 7 days, because, you know, the cell phones were dead pretty quickly. There are no ATMs on, so you can't get cash. Most of the stores aren't even open because there's power lines down and buildings are flooded. And so For that week, it was kind of my responsibility to look after my other two sets of neighbors. So it was a total, at that point, I think, of seven of us. And it was pretty interesting to see how it all kind of came about, and we all kind of pulled together without even any type of selection. It seemed like each person had a specific kind of understanding of something that would be essential during that time. My friend Brody was actually a plumber, so he understood different ways to, you know, procure those stormwater and use and what we could use it for. And we developed kind of an outdoor shower because you couldn't stay inside the houses. The AC units weren't working, and even with the windows open, they weren't stopping the level of humidity and heat that follows right after a hurricane like that. But we made it through the week, and what I found was for the next couple of years, until, you know, things came up in our professional lives, we were a very close, tight-knit group of people. And we ended up sharing our resources in every sense at that point. Most dinners were cooked together. All three of us would pitch in. One person would buy the meat. One person would bring the vegetables. The other person would bring the dessert and drinks. And we would kind of rotate around that way and cook together. And what I found was our household food bills were all cut into a third. So I think that's really interesting, that the more of us pulled together our resources, the less expensive it became for us to exist that way. And I guess you could say this is really where this idea started to originate in my head.
When you can diversify the workload, when you get different people pulling towards the same goal, I mean, this is just common sense. It becomes easier to accomplish that goal. And I find it interesting, that story, that you happen to, you know, be, you know, have those people around you that sounds like they were at least in some ways prepared for whatever was going on. My concern is that the maximum preparedness I'm going to receive from the neighbors around me is that they're prepared to lose their shit and start looting. Okay, so that's as far as that their preparedness is going to go. So the kind of things we're talking about, the kind of network we're talking about, is, you know, definitely sharing ideas on what might be a, you know, possibility, different potential strategies to. To disengage from that system, because that's one of the biggest faults, the biggest way to isolate us right now is to make us feel dependent on the system that's available, you know, the government, the entitlements that are available, things like that. When those things go away, the vast majority of people in this nation are going to be without a clue as to what to accomplish, what to do. And like you said, when the phone network goes away, when the computer systems go away, when the electricity goes away, there are going to be a lot of people, just like, you know, when Katrina hit New Orleans, just like, you know, when all these different places get hit by these natural disasters, who have absolutely nothing and no way to get anything, that they're going to be either waiting for, you know, the government to come along and pick them up, or they're going to be waiting for the opportunity to start, you know, looting and pillaging and what have you. And I almost say the looters and pillagers in that situation have at least a little bit more ambition, you know, have the idea of, you know, they want to do things for themselves, you know. But what we've been talking about has been that kind of preparedness, making sure that if something were to happen where you didn't have the system to rely on for 7 days, you still could, you know, see to your needs, you still could take care of yourself. And then once you're able to do that, once you're able to say, you know what, I'm pretty well off, I'm pretty well prepared for, you know, a systemless existence, at least for a short period of time, then you start talking to other people who are doing the same thing, talking about, okay, so what happens if, you know, this happens? What do we do? How do we get together? How do we network? How do we communicate? You know, where do we meet? Whether it's talking within your own families or what have you, or talking to your friends, you know, what is the plan? What's the plan of action? And then long term, because frankly, I don't think either of us, and a lot of people who listen to us, have any confidence that the way of life we're experiencing today is going to be here in 15 years. That there's going to be a shift, there's going to be a change, whether it's a sudden change, whether it's something, you know, external, whether it's, you know, a natural disaster or some issue that occurs that causes a major shift in the way things are done, or whether there's a gradual change, whether there's a shift. I mean, if you look at the last, you know, 30 years or so, the shift in mentality from when we were kids, we talked about this in other shows. When we were kids, you know, what we're told we could accomplish, what we saw our parents accomplishing, the land of opportunity was here. And I really think the U.S. economic system hit its stride in the 1980s, 1990s. And since then, it's been going downhill very quickly. I remember a conversation with my father, and we were talking about the economy. We were talking about the job he had. He had worked in a factory all his life, and you know, at some point, I think he was making $25-$30 an hour, pulling levers, basically moving, you know, axle parts from one point to another point in the machine system, in a automated system. And he was, you know, that was the job he grew up with. That was the job that he had had since he was like 21, and he expected it was going to be there forever. And I pointed out to him, you know, the trend was that, you know, look, the rest of the world is catching up with us. The rest of the world is industrializing. The rest of the world is you know, doing the things that we've done, that we were the only ones in the world for a long time who could do these things. Now the rest of the world is doing these things, and they're doing it cheaper. They're doing it just as well, but they're doing it for less money. So there's going to be an averaging, and I've, you know, I've tried to explain this to him, that this averaging was coming, where eventually the standard of living, the amount of money that you could get for a day's labor, that kind of thing, was going to be on par everywhere in the world. It didn't matter where you live, you were only going to be able to make X number of dollars an hour for whatever task it is you're performing. Otherwise, you couldn't compete. Because as soon as the people in Sri Lanka, as soon as the people in China, as soon as the people in Taiwan, as soon as the people whatever, say, you know what, we'll do that job for half, well, that's where the businesses go. And lo and behold, that's the situation we're in. So it's become a real culture shock for us here in the United States when you tell these people who, when their fathers were laboring in an automotive factory, you know, hey, they're making $20, $25 an hour. You tell them, hey, the job that you're doing is only going to pay 10, only going to pay, you know, 8, and give that, and that's a union job. That's a good wage. So it's a matter of trying to live within your means. It's also trying to go, you know what, do I need to be dependent on that wage for the things that I need, or can I find a way to, you know, be self-sufficient and then have that wage as just kind of a way to, you know, cushion things?
You know, what's very interesting to me is that with as long as the economy has now been on a downward trend, the prices just keep seeming to soar on all of the things that you need. I mean, a loaf of bread's fucking $2 at least nowadays. I can remember going in and paying 89 cents for a loaf, and that's in my adult life. So you're talking within the last 10, 15 years.
Right. So yeah, and the price of everything's going up. And it's, what's going on? Well, it's because these same things are, first of all, they're more expensive the world over. You know, a loaf of bread in another country, other than, you know, here in the Western civilization, has always been more expensive. But that's also because usually you made your own bread. You know, instead of you going to the store and buying your own bread, you made it yourself. And that's someplace I think where we as U.S. citizens are going to be fucked eventually. The thing we were talking about on the last show that we had this discussion about these skill sets that had been lost. These different things that were, you know, this is common knowledge, how to make bread. And who didn't know how to make bread, you know, 50 years ago? Who didn't know how to make butter 50 years ago? I consider myself a fairly well-educated person, and I had no clue. I had to go look it up. How do you make butter? You know, and I was shocked at how simple the process is if you have the materials. The same with, you know, things you talked about, making beer, making whatever. But you've talked about small engine repair, understanding electrical system, understanding plumbing, that kind of thing. Having those basic ideas of, you know, sanitation needs, so you don't shit right by your house, basically, if the plumbing goes out, and don't end up contaminating your groundwater and everything else, or fucking yourself. Having some basic knowledge of, you know, what needs, you know, what's the best way to handle yourself without those things that are always provided for you. So it's just a matter of getting into that mindset of what do I need to do to become less and less dependent on the system so that I have that cushion. I have that barrier between me, myself, and the system. So we're not even talking about, at this point, escaping the system per se. We're not talking about turning our backs on the system just yet. What we're talking about is just putting some distance between ourselves and those people who lack that preparedness, who lack that knowledge, who are going to be fucked, basically, when the system fails.
Right on. And there's a lot of them. I think most people are going to be fucked when the system fails. That's the one thing that terrifies me the most, I think. Not so long ago, maybe a year and a half or so ago, I ran across this internet-based documentary. It was called Esoteric Agenda. Did you see this?
No, I've not.
All right. Well, one of the parts in the movie, they talk about there being some NATO-level decision to kind of kill us off. Slowly, but within a consistent rate, because of the fact that there's limited resources here on Earth. Now, I realize, you know, this is like an off the wall, out of their mind conspiracy that they're talking about. But the fact that somebody can imagine that means that somebody could imagine it and do it. And that in itself leads me to believe that, you know, you've ultimately got to be very cautious. And just about everything that you're doing and how you exist in this world.
Right on. And you could definitely see that coming where, let's say there's some sort of a situation where, you know, the government has to step in. You've got a disaster. You've got whatever going on where, you know what, there's just too many mouths to feed and not enough food to go around. I can tell you that, you know, from a military point of view, you're going to do what you can. You're going to allocate your resources in a way to make sure that you're, you know, first of all, you're able to maintain order. So that's going to be key. So the first people that are going to get fed are going to be the soldiers because they're able to maintain order. The other people that are the non-soldiers are kept weak with hunger. Well, then they're easier to manage. They're easier to maintain. And then you start looking at essential personnel, doctors and things like that. So there'll be a triage kind of mentality if something like that were to occur. So even if it wasn't a... you know, somebody looking long-term and going, look, there's 300 million people in the United States. All of them are entitlement-driven. None of them have any real skill sets for survival. If the shit were to hit the fan, we're going to have 300 million people who know nothing but to pick up boards and weapons and whatever they have and go nuts. So maybe it would be better off if we start choking some of these people off. Maybe we'd be better off if certain things started happening to our population. And this is a huge conspiracy theory, but it's definitely possible. And I know that a lot of people are probably even questioning whether or not it's already happening. You know, whether, you know, contamination of our drinking water, whether different things being put into our food, whether different diseases. I mean, the thing that, you know, floored us, I know, of a month or so ago, that report that HIV is now being used as a potential cure for cancer. There's a lot of, you know, double, you know, looking at that going, you know, okay, well, what's happened? Maybe there was something to those theories that HIV was engineered. There's different things going on that just kind of makes you wonder. And it seems like it's becoming more and more clear that the common sense thing to do is go, you know, being around this system, being around this bloated and corrupt and, you know, inherently dangerous system is less and less of a good idea. And at some point, I need to seriously consider thinking about getting away from it, being as difficult to find by those people who are engaged in it as possible. Frankly, if the shit hits the fan tomorrow, the biggest thing I'm concerned about is not lack of food, it's not lack of water, it's not, you know, not lack of resources, being able to take care of myself and my family. It's the nut jobs around me. It's the animals that could become unchained should they suddenly not have the governing forces to control them and to pacify them. They're not getting their little things that they want, so they look for other ways to entertain themselves. I'm not a little dude, but my, you know, my three daughters and my girlfriend, they're little people. They're not very physically adept, and I have concerns about what might happen. It seems like the faster we get the hell out of Dodge, or the further away from Dodge, the better off we might be.
Right on, man. I mean, in some ways, you almost have yourself stockaded off from the world now. I mean, maybe not necessarily you, but I mean, if you think about it, you aren't just walking down MLK, you know, doing whatever anymore, because there's an element of danger. There's already animals off of the chain. You know, there's already people that are desperate out there and doing things that they wouldn't normally do. It's interesting to me how much robberies here in the Tampa Bay area have increased, or people being arrested for petty theft or breaking an entry has increased. To me, this is usually when people go out and steal. It's because they need something, you know.
Right, right. Yeah, you don't go out and steal something necessarily because you want it and you don't need it, or you want because you're not lacking something. Because you don't invest energy into getting something unless you have an absolute need. Most people are lazy. Let's be frank. An interesting story along those lines that I heard recently is people are now, with gold prices going up, people are literally snatching jewelry off of women as they walk down the street. If you see a woman walking down the street with a gold necklace, there are criminals or people, you know, who are coming up and tearing the necklaces right off their necks and hauling ass because the gold has value. It has an inherent value that, a value to the people who buy and trade the shit. And so they're taking it to the pawn shop or whatever and getting enough dollars for it that it makes it worth their while to pull that kind of crime. And it's funny that, you know, in a society where, first of all, if our value structures were different, where that kind of thing, the gold itself, you recognize that it's a malleable metal. It doesn't serve much function. That it doesn't have a lot of value as far as, you know, the hunter-gatherer sense, what can you use this for? And then that, you know, the things that you need, you could procure on your own. You know, the food, the shelter, and everything else, you could go out and get those things just by, you know, being in nature and having a little bit of common knowledge. You could go ahead and make these things happen for yourself. But those opportunities don't exist, and our value structures are skewed.
Right on. Well, I just want to kind of, while we're taking a quick breather here, mention we got Zach on the air, so I'm going to go ahead and pull him on.
Okay.
Great.
Zach, what's going on, man?
Hey, good evening, gentlemen. How you doing?
What's up?
All right?
Yeah, I just want to chime in and say something. I know it's a little late, but it took me a few minutes to get out here and call, so it might be a little after the fact, but we're talking about trades and if shit actually collapsed and hit the fan, right, if there's an actual meltdown in America where we, you know, had to rely on our natural resources. The people that would prosper the most would be, ironically, the people that are usually trampled underfoot. You know, it would be your blue-collar people would be your mechanics to fix your cars. You know, it'd be your electricians, it'd be your plumbers. It'd be the people that are looked upon now in society as, you know, having a lowly position. But these are the people that would rise above and be the most successful if it came down to no cash and it was, you know, strictly on a barter system, which may one day happen.
Well, yeah, I agree with that. I think it go even further. But, yeah, your trades are definitely – those people are going to have the most value in a society where you don't have the system to rely on, where your power is not coming from the big generator down, you know, the big plant. In the middle of the county, any hope you have of having an electrical power has to come from a little generator, and you have to have somebody who knows how to wire that shit together. So absolutely, that's going to be one. There are going to be people who are going to be that prosper in a system breakdown, a system meltdown, because their skills are going to be in demand. The other people I see faring very well are the people who are already not engaged in the system. I talk a lot of smack about transients and everything else, but there's an aspect of that lifestyle, and I don't want to romanticize being a transient, being homeless or what have you. I understand the reality of it is it's a very harsh life and sucks that most people wouldn't choose to be there, although I've read of some people who do. You know, some people with PhDs choosing that lifestyle. But these people that are already out there who know what's going on as far as, you know, being out, living off the land and that kind of thing, they're also going to be very successful in a society where the system has collapsed. And I don't think we're looking at – and the other thing is, you know, we all talk about a meltdown. We all talk about that's the thing we talk about is a disaster, that kind of breakdown. But the other thing I think might be happening is a little bit more insidious is the slow shift to you becoming more and more dependent on the system for what your needs are, to a point where, you know what, since the jobless situation is so bad in the United States – as soon as you graduate from high school, what we're going to do is we're going to go ahead and just assign you a job. That way we make sure you have a position. That we're going to have the government come in and we're going to have the government take over more and more industries to make sure that, you know, everybody has a job. That way everybody has what they need. that we're going to see that kind of thing going on, and there are going to be some of us that, you know, like, what government is going to go, you know what, tattoo artists are essential. Let's go ahead and make you a tattoo artist. No, they're going to have me a shovel to do the ditches, and I'm not going to be down. So, yeah, the trade skills, having that skill, being able to go, you know, if I could say, you know, yeah, I'm a tattoo artist and everything else, but I also, you know, I know how to fix jet engines and shit. It would be nice to be able to do that. So, yeah, I see your point, definitely, that those people will be more successful either way the system goes.
Yeah, you know, when it comes to transients, it's like, you know, transients have figured out a way to survive under the radar without getting a check. You know, they figured out a way to eat, find shelter, you know, and granted, yeah, it is a bleak life, but they figured out a way to do it. Not that I would want to do it. I have done it, but and it's not fun. But, yeah, they figured out a way to do it. These people will have no problem if there's a meltdown because they're living like it already happened. The rest of us will have to totally reevaluate our priorities and our lifestyles and really figure out what's important. Now, recently here, and this just happened a couple of days ago, I don't know if you've caught wind of it, but there was a power outage that lasted for 16 hours, and it affected all of San Diego County, which is 3.5 million people, Orange County, which is another like 3 million people, parts of Arizona, parts of New Mexico, parts of Mexico. Estimated over somewhere between 10 to 15 million people were out of power for 16 hours. And we're not just talking like out of power, like literally no power in the city, like the traffic lights didn't work. If there was like a no driving law, it was basically the city was locked down, except for cops and emergency ambulances and fire trucks and shit. And it was really weird. You don't really realize how attached you are to your, you know, electronics until they're taken away from you. I mean, I came out here, and it's like, okay, it's pitch black. There's nothing to do. And everybody else is standing on their patio, too. We're just, like, looking around at each other. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, well, you know what? I got a fridge full of food that's fucking melting. Let's eat this shit. So what we did is, you know, we went to the convenience store, you know, bought a fucking obscenely expensive bag of charcoal, you know, because that was one of the few left. And we had a barbecue, and all of us neighbors sat around, and we just threw all of our fucking food that was going to go bad, you know, our pork chops, our chickens, our sausages, our steaks, threw all that shit on the fucking patio, or on the barbecue, and just fucking got drunk and just ate that shit, sat out here all night and drank. I mean, it was kind of cool, but that was only day one. You know, I could see how, like, pushing day three, pushing day four, people would be pretty stressed, very stressed.
Yeah, what caused the outage, you know?
What's that?
What caused the outage, do you know?
Yeah, it was a serviceman fucked up a major power line when he was working on it. And unfortunately affected the entire Southern California and parts of southern southwest United States.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
I'm sure he got fired.
Well, I mean,
go ahead.
Who's that?
Go ahead. They estimated the cost, like, the damages for the power being out for 16 hours is upwards of $500 million, they estimate.
Oh,
you know, for loss of business. Because there was no power. Every single fucking business had to shut down.
Wow.
Right. You know, it's interesting when you are in a situation like that. I mean, you only went through a you know, 16-hour period. I went through a seven-day period back in 2004. It's interesting to me because I didn't, prior to that, have any real notion of, you know, reconsidering my priorities on things. I mean, our first 48 hours was very much like you're describing you guys did. We cooked all the food we had, drank all the beer. It was, you know, a paid vacation in a nutshell from work and from the everyday hustle and bustle. But when all that food's gone and when all the alcohol is gone and there's still no running water because everything there was well-driven and, you know, wells take power to fucking run. So, you know, the situation gets pretty desperate pretty fast. And then, you know, that's why I think that it's a good idea for people to reevaluate their priorities now.
Right, right. Why wait for the disaster to occur? And, you know, then your situation, of course, is it going to be 16 hours? Is it going to be 7 days? Is it going to be 3 months? What's the going to be the effect? What's going to be the overall toll? My thing is I hope that I have enough time, enough warning to, you know, pack the family up and get the hell out. You know, I'd rather be camping for a month, you know, with whoever I'm hanging out with the people that I'm networking with, making sure that we're all right and doing our thing, and eventually having somebody come out and go, hey, you know what, everything's back to normal, than to have, you know, then to be out here going, you know, God, I hope the emergency supply truck comes by today because we're starving.
Right on. Right on, man. I mean, there's a couple of things that I learned instantly that you can do to always be kind of sort of prepared for these things. Like one of the things is never to have your vehicle below 3/4 of a tank with gasoline. You're always topping it off, always making sure that you've got almost a full tank of gasoline so that you can get to where you know there are others that you could network with.
Right on.
That's definitely good advice. Another one is to have I'd say at least 10 gallons of water on reserve in case the water supply goes bad or something.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think another thing is to make sure that you always have a supply of canned meats and canned vegetables and stuff, that you don't rely on having everything freezer frozen and refrigerator kept, you know, and just as a backup supply, because if you, you know, can build up a week's worth of food for your family, you increase your chances of you know, surviving in a catastrophe by that much. I mean, if you've got a week's worth of food, then when you go out and hunt, you're not under the pressure of knowing that if you don't catch anything that day, your family doesn't eat. But if you do catch something, that means it's one more day your family will eat.
Right, and along that way of thinking, having that week's worth of food, having more, you know, as much as you can possibly store, as much as it is convenient and as you prepare for, it's not just a buffer against a natural disaster. Let's talk about other disasters. Let's talk about a personal economic disaster. Let's say you lose your job. Let's say, the plant you work at or whatever closes down. Or, you know, you live a life like mine and you don't do any business for a month. Being able to go without buying groceries for a week because, you know, the money's not there, but you also have a week's worth of groceries, you know, sealed and stored and ready to go, ready to eat. That's an incredible amount of peace of mind. A lot of the stress that a lot of people live under, living paycheck to paycheck, is driving us insane slowly. So having that, you know, having that extra food laying around, having, you know, as far as, it, let's say, money, we talk about money being worthless, but while it's worth something to somebody, you know, preparing ahead and having, you know, a savings account someplace, putting a little bit of money away so that, let's say, again, you know, you don't have that buffer, you don't have that option, and the income's not coming in. This is my world, man. This is where I live, basically, because, you know, if I can't set the appointments, if I can't sell the artwork, if I can't get that coming in, well then, you know, my piece of the income for our household isn't there. So I definitely have to make sure that when times are good, that I'm packing it away. Otherwise, you know, I'm fucking myself. And I see all these people that live paycheck to paycheck, and I can't imagine. I understand how they do it. I understand they get there, and it's part of this kind of sickness we have in our society, where we assume that everything will just be the way it is now, and it will continue on. It's inherent in human nature, basically, that no matter what's going on, we always assume that this will be the case forever and ever. We don't consider the possibility that it would change. We understand that exists, but it's never going to happen to us. It's never going to be us that gets hit by the storm. It's never going to be us that gets fired. It's never going to be us that loses whatever. And so we're not prepared for it when it does occur, even though it's a real possibility. So having that buffer, having that distance between yourself and, you know, financial collapse or, you know, hunger, starvation or, you know, not having water, it's a huge relief, I think.
certainly. I would agree with that entirely. As a matter of fact, I would kind of point back to Maslow's hierarchy of needs and show that, you know, if you can't fulfill those, or if you're worried about fulfilling those lower levels of needs, that there's no way that you can maintain being an actualized person. So it is a corrosive thing to your psyche when you're living paycheck to paycheck, or you're stressed out about where the next $5 is coming from so you can buy a gallon of milk and a fucking, you know, thing of eggs.
Yeah, I'm looking at, there's a question in the chat room that just popped up. Tim is Hardcore asked, what happens when money becomes of no value? And I think he's responding to Allison's comment that a saving plan is 30% of your income in savings, which is a good idea. The issue isn't a matter of what happens when money has no value. I think that's going to eventually happen. You're going to see an economic collapse. The point, the goal, I think, would be to become truly financially independent, to make sure that while the money does have some value, while the money has inherent value to somebody, that you're taking that money and you're getting the things that will have value to you when money is worthless. So using that money to, you know, prepare. But also, while you're using this system, while you're paying rent to somebody, while you're paying your electric bills and everything else, while the system is still in place, and you have a sort of obligation to engage that system, then it's a good idea to have that money in reserve. So I know that I think we talked about this in other shows about how I'm kind of reducing my material goods. I'm reducing what it is I have in my household and everything else, and then I'm turning those funds into things that I think that I will need, or I'm using it to create that buffer or help, you know, further that buffer that I already have. If the money were to go away tomorrow, I would be out, you know, 3 months worth of my regular income, because now it's worthless. But I have other things here that have interesting, you know, inherent value. So most of my wealth now, because of this shift, I guess, in the way I think, is invested in, you know, the things that I have that actually have something that's worthwhile, or things that are useful, things like that. Commodities, not bits of entertainment, not things of that nature, status symbols and things like that. I'm trying to eschew all of those things from my life.
Right. Now, Jason, I really quick wanted to kind of make a point in case anybody hasn't really thought of this. Should, you know, the financial system of the world collapse tomorrow, you have a small window of opportunity in which people are going to believe that it's going to come back on, or, you know, come back online, so to speak. And so that would be the time to quickly divest yourself of all that money and gain things that will be useful from that point on.
Absolutely, absolutely. So if you've got that, yeah, if you've got that cash on hand, that's the other thing to think about, is that it's to start thinking about things that you can trade. Okay, so it's not, you know, money is, we've been trained to believe that money, the bills and coins we're given, are the only things that are equitable, the only things that we can use for trade. There are many other things we can use for trade, but money should be among them, because even if you know that the money you have is worthless, there are going to be other people that might see some value in that money, might be willing to trade for it. When you guys are talking about taking, you know, simple things to be prepared, some simple steps to take, you know, having three quarts of tank of gas at all times, that kind of thing. The fires here in Austin, Texas got a lot, or not Austin, but Bastrop. The fires here in Bastrop got a lot of people talking about how they wish they had taken the time to have that go bag that we were talking about, that basically to have a few items, a few of the things that they absolutely have to have, you know, IDs and birth certificates and, you know, a little bit of money, the family jewels, who the fuck knows, you know, the precious items. They wish they'd had them all collected and gathered in one suitcase, ready to go, so that when they were told to evacuate, they could have just grabbed their suitcases and hauled ass, because now those things are gone. So that, I think, is another excellent thing that, you know, for people to consider as they're thinking about their own situations, as hopefully they're beginning to change their perspective on things, one of the steps to take is to make sure that look around where you live. If you were told, you know, you've got 2 minutes to get the hell out, what is it that you would grab? What are the things that you would take with you?
And then really consider those objects. Are they really worth grabbing? Are they really worth, you know, the effort? You want to make sure that, you know, you're not burdened by just ridiculous shit that's worthless.
Right on. While I'm thinking about this, in the event of a zombie holocaust or some nuclear, you know, nuclear doomsday, anybody left over should, you know, if they want to, make their way down here to Clearwater, Florida, because I've pretty much got a good handle on how to survive on nothing, so.
Right on, right on. Yeah, I was talking to people about how the big push will be to get out to Florida, to get out to the coast, to do some fishing, to hang out. It's wherever you're at, the people you're networking with. That's the thing that we kind of opened the show with. Start, you know, if you're talking to people, if you have people that ideologically you're on the same playing field, that you think you're checking each other out. So there's this, you know, this second phase where there's this, you know, you're doing your thing and you're sharing information with other people as you're trying to learn things. You're trying to gather information for yourself. And as you discuss these ideas, if you start finding people that are like-minded, you start finding people that are also interested in these pursuits, they have these concerns and are willing to do something about it, well, then maybe those are the people you need to talk to. Hey, you know what? The two of us would be better able to defend our families together than just the one of us trying to do it on our own. The two of us might have a better time, you know, procuring the things we need, making sure that we gather the resources that we need than just one of us. I mean, if I could think about it this way, you spend less fuel having one campfire and, you know, sharing it than having, you know, two campfires someplace else. So,
right.
You know, it could make things a little bit easier. So definitely that networking. And then I guess the other thing would be, if there's things you can do now, if you find you're interacting with people that they're getting their shit together, they're thinking along the same line, if there are things that you could do right now, why wait? Why prepare for the shit to hit the fan? Why not start doing those things right now? And again, you know, putting some distance between you and that system, because what could happen is that thing, when that thing collapses, when a boat sinks in the ocean or whatever, when it goes in the water, its mass displaces a bunch of water. So everything around the boat gets sucked down with it. Well, I see the system doing the same thing. When that collapse occurs, whether it's quickly or slowly, there's going to be a displacement of resources. There's going to be a displacement of people. And if you don't have some distance between you and that system, you're going to get sucked down with it.
Right on, man. I mean, that's kind of the whole thing of what I'm trying to do here. I've been working very hard at kind of self-sustaining myself to a point that, I really am hoping in the future here I'll be able to start reporting good results to people and explaining to them some of the things that I'm trying out right now. But at this point, everything's sort of in an experimental phase, and most of the results have kind of been not so good, you know?
Right on, right on. Well, a lot of the shit we're doing here, we're reducing our utilities. So very careful monitoring of, you know, how we use the electricity that we do use, making sure that, you know, windows are insulated and covered. But really, a lot of it has to do with just keeping the sunlight out of the apartment building during the apartment during the daytime, so that the apartment doesn't get heated up. Keeping it cool is pretty easy, but you know, doing little things to help cut my utility bill down to like a third of what it would have been without taking these steps, what it used to be. We're starting to build up a hefty stock of water in our pantry, so having that, you know, peace of mind that, you know, because I. Like I said a couple of weeks ago, we experienced a little situation where we didn't have water for a day, and that's inconvenient. I couldn't imagine what it would be like if it were 3 days or 4 days without water, and we're facing this drought here in Texas. I have a feeling that if it continues, and they're expecting this thing to continue, and it's going to get worse and worse each year, that like you see rolling power outages in the rest of the nation, well, here what you're going to see is rolling water outages where your taps are only going to work on odd number of days or even number of days depending on where you're living or whatever. And if you don't have water on hand, if you don't actually have taken the time to make sure that you had water stored up, you're going to find yourself in dire straits. You're going to find yourself without water for, you know, 24 hours or what have you. And after then, the PSAs will be out there, the public service announcements will be out there saying that during your day, you know, make sure you're storing up some water, make sure you're refilling a certain size, you know, some bottle or what have you, so that you have water for the day, that you don't have, you know, the water on tap. So yeah, just, you know, take some steps and try to reduce. I guess that's the other thing we're doing is just we're reducing what we're feeding into the system. We're reducing our connection to it. So, you know, those simple things, it's going well. And then we're talking to other people, you know, we're actually speaking about these things to people, seeing what they think, seeing what their ideas are, letting them know that there are other options. Because I think that's the other thing that's key, is that a lot of people don't recognize, you know, again, what's right in front of their faces. You know, they know things are bad. They know the situation seems to be getting worse. But the idea that they can actually do something, the idea that they actually have options, is just foreign to them. You know, instead they're just waiting on, you know, the next handout, the next, you know, authority to come down and go, it's all okay, we've got it taken care of, go back to your lives.
Right on. I mean, one thing I think that people should really start getting into their head is this system is not going to recover. It's not going to get any better. I mean, there's just no foreseeable way that it's going to happen. All of these proposals that I've seen going up at the big government level right now, all detail, you know, a very long, long plan before any kind of real success is achieved. So that to me says that they know that it's hopeless, and they're just giving you, you know, that carrot dangling out in front of you.
Right. Well, it's a collapsing structure. I think that's what people need to recognize, that, you know, this system that we're on is falling apart. It's collapsing. And the most they can hope for right now is stabilization, but it's not going to be at the same level that it was stabilized at before. And growth, I mean, the system that's collapsing, it can't support additional growth. So if there were to be any kind of progress, it's going to have to go in a different direction. It's going to mean that if the system wants to stabilize and maintain whatever it ends up stabilizing to, it's going to have to shift the way that the system's structured. The foundation that it's built upon will have to change. And that in itself is disconcerting, because it may mean a lot of the ideologies that we've come to count upon, a lot of the ideals that we believe are, you know, our fundamental freedoms, our beliefs in certain things about what it is we can or cannot do, that may have to change. Or, you know, we find ourselves afoul of that system and facing whatever legal consequences are put in place.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the thing of it is that any one man, even with the greatest vision of the big picture, couldn't imagine what's actually coming next. So, you know, it's just kind of a scary thing, especially when you're hearing so many of these would-be experts, you know, giving different rundowns or scenarios, and none of them seem to be too confident of what's coming next, of how things are going to stabilize. I think we're fooling ourselves if we think that we can depend on something as enormous as this system that's in place is now. That's one of the reasons why I've been so interested in this clan idea. Is because that I see this as being the only way that you can create some stability for yourself immediately.
Well, and just to underline that point, that, you know, these experts can't they don't know exactly what's going to happen, but they can only guess. And a lot of what they do when they put out information, part of that is to pacify the masses, to make sure that nobody panics. When Obama put out this first round of stimulus packages to try to help, you know, stabilize the economy, the intent was that they were going to, you know, create all these jobs, that the money was going to be stabilized, and they were going to hold unemployment to a single-digit number, you know, 8%, 9%. It wouldn't get any worse. Well, it didn't help. So now when they've come out with this second round of stimulus packages they're talking about, knowing that, you know, anybody that's out there looking for a job and everything else, they'll tell you that it's 19% unemployment. It's, you know, it's not just people that are on the books who are actively, you know, drawing from unemployment looking for a job. It's people who have given up, who are no longer engaged in it. You know, they took the fry cook job or whatever. They're not working for their industry anymore, the industry they were working in before.
So they, you know, the real numbers for unemployment are actually closer to 19-20% now. So the new round of stimulus packages, they're actually telling people, you know, they're not saying that this is going to reverse anything. They're not promising what they will do. They're just saying that they're going to go ahead and put this money out there.
Right. I mean, that's a scary thing when you sit and really think about it, because what does that mean for the person that has existed for the past 20 years, you know, on a minimum wage paycheck?
Right, exactly. Because, yeah, when those jobs go away, when that person's job goes away, I mean, you're barely skilled anyways. But then, you know, you've got this task when you go out to go get another job. I mean, if you've been at that thing for 20 years or whatever, and your job, your position was basically an entry level position, and it's gone away, but it was, you know, someplace, and I find that hard to imagine, but I know it exists. When you turn around and try to find another job, well, now you're not 18 years old trying to get an entry level position. You're 38, you're 39, you're 40 years old. Most of the managers you'd be talking to are younger than you are. And, you know, what would happen? That manager is going to look at you and go, you know, there's no way I can hire this guy because he's got obligations that the average person I have working for me doesn't have. He's got different things, different experiences. You know, how do I teach this old dog some new tricks? It's just not going to happen. So I could find even if you're not making minimum wage, any industry you've been in for a long time, trying to get out as an adult and retrain or requalify for some of these jobs, it's going to be difficult.
Yeah, I know, man. I know that firsthand.
But on the other hand, you know, it's, if you can get to that point where if I do take that Brico job, a movie that comes to mind, American Beauty, okay, the idea that this guy, he had this job. He's working in this industry forever. He hates his job, hates his life. All this shit goes on, and he finds a way out. I think he kind of blackmailed his boss, saying that basically he filed a sexual harassment lawsuit. But what have you? He gave up that job and went and worked as a fry cook, as a drive-through window guy, because it was the job he had in high school. Back when he was in high school, that was when he was happiest. So, you know, when he's applying for the job, he goes and says, because he's got everything else already figured out. And I think that's what we're talking about. You know, he's not worried about paying his bills. He's not worried about, you know, making sure the rent gets paid. He's not worried about where the food's coming from because he's already got that taken care of. So now what he's doing is going out and going, you know what, I want a job just so I have a job. I want the least responsibility possible. Okay, so there's a flip side to this being prepared thing. There's a flip side to this. It, the freedom it might offer the person is actually, you know, going, you know what, I don't have a job, I'm still good because I got everything taken care of already. I worked with a guy, I used to work security years ago, and I worked with a guy who had worked, he was a city commissioner or something like that. He did all kinds of things. He's an older guy. He lived in Ohio and everything, and he drove into Indiana to do a security job, and he only did it part-time. And the thing was, he told me, you know, it's always best to have some fuck you money, to have enough put away, to have enough of your own, whatever it is you need to have to get by, that if you don't like your job, you can just say fuck you and walk away. And it was like one of the most brilliant pieces of wisdom I had ever heard.
Right on, man. Right on. Unfortunately, it's difficult nowadays to get to that position. If you haven't already, at this point, started some kind of fuck you fun like you're talking about, the chances are it might be too late.
Yeah, and the thing with this is that, again, it's this shift in value structures that we're talking about. It's, you know, it's not just a matter of, like, we've been taught, make sure that you have 3 months worth of your bills taken care of. Make sure you have 3 months worth of grocery money taken care of and everything else. Well, it's easier to get to that 3 month buffer if groceries aren't something you're factoring into that budget, where you, instead of having the money to buy the groceries, because like somebody pointed out, the money might be worthless tomorrow. So instead of having the money to buy the groceries, you've got the groceries already.
Right.
So instead of having, you know, it's the system has been geared, it's been gamed to make sure that more and more people are living paycheck to paycheck so that you're more dependent on that system. So if the shit does hit the fan for you personally,
well, then you have nothing to turn to but the government. You're encouraged not to get prepared. You're encouraged not to think ahead. And it's nobody's, you know, it's nobody's fault but your own, but it's also, you know, it's been set against you. You know, we've been taught that this is the land of opportunity. This is the land of prosperity. Who knew that you could find yourself in a situation? you've got years of experience. You've been working in one industry. You did all the right things. You made all the right choices, and you lived the American dream. You did what every American goes out and does. You know, you enjoyed the money. You enjoyed, you know, the position you were in, and you thought it was going to be stable. And then they pull the rug out from under you. So, you know, you find yourself basically dependent again, dependent on mom and dad, but not mom and dad are now the government. Start taking those. My daughter is a perfect example of this. My kid, my 17-year-old, she doesn't work. She just gets lunch money every week from mom and me. What she'll do is she'll buy, you know, she'll take her mom's lunch money, and she'll make her food here. She'll make a sandwich or whatever for herself here. So I'm subsidizing her lunch, and then it's her income. You know, it's the way she's packing away money, and she's got a huge amount of money packed away. Based on 4 years of this little trick she's been playing on her parents, and I'm hoping that, you know, she's able to continue that trend in the future when she's out of high school.
Right on. I mean, and that's really, I think the most important thing here is that, you know, these are things that need to be picked up at a much younger age than what they are being picked up. It's not usually until you hit into certain realities or a rough spot in life that you look back and go, oh, I could have done these things to be prepared. I mean, if this was something that was talked about, you know, at the lunch table in high school, just think of how much better people would be.
Right on, right. Well, yeah, and that's as we said before. They're saying in the chat room that the show's cutting in and out.
It's probably just the 15 minutes. What?
Yeah, we got 45 minutes left.
Yeah, I have no idea. It does that from time to time.
Okay, well, we'll keep rolling on. If you can't hear us in the chat room, let us know. But yeah, this will be after it'll be archived and everything. As we said in other shows, the generation of people that are going to have the most difficulty dealing with this transition are those of us who have been taught that everything's going to be great. Just keep believing in the system, keep invested, you know, be part of the workforce, get involved, get engaged in that way. And you'll be taken care of. You'll have your own money. You'll have all the opportunity in the world to live the dream. We're the ones who are kind of fucked. We're the ones that have to make that big transition. Our kids are going to grow up seeing our struggle, just like they did back during the Depression. The people that came through the Depression, their children saw what was going on, and they took steps to make sure that they would not have to go through that themselves. So it's the same. Our children are going to be doing the same thing. They're going to see, you know, what it is that we're going through, and hopefully, you know, they'll take steps to make sure that they themselves don't have to experience that. Okay. Let me pop something in the chat room here.
Are you watching this shit? Apparently the show's ended. I mean, there's 40 fucking minutes left. And
weird. Let me see here. No, they can't hear us.
What the hell?
Okay. Yeah, I don't know where. Okay, we got some people can hear us, some people can't hear us. All right.
Right, and I think everybody just needs to refresh. So if Diablo can, or if he can just tell everybody they need to refresh, since I know he's hearing us, then we should be able to continue on.
Yeah, it looks like everybody's logged out and logged back in.
Right on. Oh, Jesus. You know, we pay for this shit, man, and yet we still have these problems. I mean, I think it's time for a good long bitch letter.
Yeah, that there are issues with the system. We're paying for this premium fee and everything else, and that
yeah, we're going to be told that these, you know, that there's always going to be system issues and everything else. But yeah, I mean, it might be time to go. There's a problem. On the other hand, I don't want, you know, them going, okay, there's a special reason to look at the ooze and see what's going on. So,
well, I don't necessarily think that there's anything that they could find within the content of our show to give us any hard pressed issues anyway.
Oh, it's not that. That wouldn't be the issue at all. It would be that, hey, those guys, they like to complain and they like to bitch. You know? And so let's make sure that they find it, you know, too inconvenient to use Blog Talk Radio and they decide to choose to leave. That could be, you know, the way it goes. But yeah, I think pointing it out to them that, hey, we're experiencing these issues, at least seeing what technical advice they might offer, that might be worthwhile.
Right. That's something I'll follow up on this week, man.
Go ahead.
I was just thinking to myself, this puzzle, and this is what, like the fourth or fifth episode that we've discussed this, and it just seems like we never, we're not really getting too much further from what we were. I mean, it's nice to talk about it, but it would be even nicer if somehow we could inflict some change.
Well, I think maybe that's something we should discuss then. And we're talking about change. Are you talking about changes? Because you can being prepared, getting ready, getting yourself together, and then getting together with other people and starting to do something, that I think is pretty common sense. Once you start taking, you know, your own self-determination seriously, it's common sense really to take these steps. So when you're talking about change, are you talking about the actual, you know, implementation of some of these ideas where – we're expanding a network, we're trying to get people involved or whatever? Are you talking about the other end of it where, you know, you still have to engage the system? Like I pointed out, money still has some sort of intricacy, you know, inherent value. There's money, the people, so it's a good idea they have money to still be engaged in, you know, in some way the regular economy. So while the system is shifting, while the system has this momentum, even if the momentum's in a direction that's not positive, it's just momentum, which means it can be nudged, it can be pushed. So is that the kind of change you're talking about?
Yeah, that's pretty much the kind of change that I'm talking about. I'm more mean that you know, people should be giving good, serious thought to, you know, getting to a physically closer locality to people of their own mindset. I mean, again, I want to point back to the idea of a clan and make the statement once again that you triple, or, you know, if there's two of you, you double your security, you double your chance of survival. If there's three, you triple it, and so forth. You know, so that kind of thing can work regardless of whether this system collapses or not. But on top of that, not only can it work for stabilizing and securing you, but then it gives you a vehicle to maybe create a corrosive element and remove the things that are at this point a burden. I mean, I don't think that there will ever be, you know, a time of just small tribes again where, you know, you have the Iroquois and the Mohawks going at it or something like that. But, you know, ultimately, one way or the other, you benefit by building yourself a clan.
Right. I think if people have read Atlas Shrugged, the idea that there was this town in the Rockies, basically, that everybody moved to, all the elite or the intellectuals, all the workers, all the people that actually made shit happen, they got the hell out of the system and moved to this town. And it was there that, you know, they all had common resources. They all, you know, engaged in trade with one another. They established their own paradigm. They established their own politics and the way to do things. I think that idea has a lot of weight to what it is we're talking about. I think, you know, first of all, talking about these different ideas, what you need to do to, or what would be a good idea for you to do to kind of, you know, get yourself ready to, you know, to put that buffer again between yourself and the system. And then that next step is talking to people about what it is they're doing, getting engaged, finding out what their level of commitment is to the ideas that you're talking about. And then everybody doing a really serious self-evaluation.
do you want to still be engaged in this system 5 years from now, 10 years from now? Or do you want to find a way out? Do you want to find a way to do your own thing? And those people that want an out, that are looking for that, you know, that escape strategy, that exit strategy, the thing we're talking about is, and I, you know, again, we talked about this in other places, but talking about moving to an actual geographic location, whether it's in Florida or wherever, where we enough of us amass there that we can look out for one another's needs, we can look out for one another's welfare, that we can kind of, even if it's, you know, even if it's everybody living in one little neighborhood, well, in that neighborhood, things are run differently because the people that live there run them differently. So, you know, having this idea, you know, of getting away, truly getting free of the system, might mean that, you know, we have a little enclave of reality all to ourselves and within the existing system. So it would be a matter of, if this is something you're engaged in, if this is something you're actively pursuing, first of all, you'd have to demonstrate that you are, in fact, pursuing these things, that you are capable of, you know, putting some distance between yourself and the system, that you don't need to be dependent on other people. If you lack that within you, if you lack the ability to become independent, then you're not going to do much good to this kind of enclave, this kind of process. We understand that there's going to be some dependence, some codependency between different groups, between different people and everything, but you have to at least be able to show that you have the wherewithal to get where it is you need to go and to support yourself for a short time while you're there, while you're actually getting established. And then it's just a matter of coming up with a plan, the group of people that we're talking to, the people that share this ideology or whatever, coming together and going, okay, this is where we're going to go, this is where we're going to meet, and that's the plan. And what's our timetable?
Right on. And I think if people are going to do this, you know, on their own or in conjunction with us or, you know, whatever the, you know, situation may be, that they should certainly look at every aspect of it and really examine what it's going to take before they hastily make any move forward.
There's a question in the chat room real quick. There's a, and this is, the question is, why get free when you can try to remove the system? I would say, you're saying, we say tomato and you're saying tomato. What's the difference, I guess, between getting free of the system and removing the system? If you're talking about destroying the system, I'd rather invest my energies in my own self-preservation, invest my energies in the preservation of the people that share my ideology, that I know I can take care of, than trying to destroy a system that, first of all, is collapsing on its own. When that system collapses, something will rise up to replace it. And whatever that thing is, I don't want to be a part of that. Now, if the system that rises up to replace it are these little enclaves that we're talking about, then that's all fine and good. But I have a feeling there's going to be a few more collapses, a few more adjustments before we reach that point, before a rational way of thinking is commonplace throughout all humanity and all societies. So the only thing we can hope to do is establish some kind of model for the society we'd like to see.
Right. I mean, I think it's really a difference here, and I want to say that there's absolutely nothing wrong with, you know, getting that sucker punch in on the system every chance that you get. But at this point, in my head, it's not it's not a prudent idea to fly kamikaze pilot into the, you know, into the walls of something. And, you know.
I agree with that, but I did talk about the idea that there's a certain momentum. The system is in transition, and since it's in transition, it can be nudged, it can be moved. Whether you're hastening that transition or you're getting to, while the system is in place, getting it to do certain things that you want to see done. That means engaging in, you know, these political tools that we have. That means, you know, going in and discussing these different ideas. That means that, you know, let's say you want pot legalized. Well, then you push for pot to be legalized and you show the failings of the system being, you know, part of it, the opposition to marijuana or whatever is the reason the system's falling apart. You know, that so you get, you know, get pot legalized, get prostitution legalized, whatever it is you want to go for it. Use the system or, you know, be out there, you know, drumming to people's heads
that the system is collapsing, and we need to, you know, you need to go ahead and we need to just tear it all down completely. That, you know, that's super. Do that. But when you tear it apart, I always ask, what happens next? What happens after the system collapsed? What happens? So you've torn it apart. You've successfully destroyed the system. Then what? Now, if you've got a plan, you've got something that you're going to replace it, well, why aren't you engaged in that now? And hopefully you are. Hopefully you're taking those steps as well. But if your plan is just, you know, we're just going to blow it up and then see what happens next, that, you know, my family can't afford that. My family can't afford to be engaged in that kind of thinking. So that's why we're talking about what it is we're talking about, I think, about being prepared to get a, be away from it. Whether somebody tears the system down or the system collapses on its own, I don't want to be around that thing when the ship sinks.
Right. I'm with you there, Jason. I just kind of want to point out, because, I mean, I honestly, I have nothing but the mind for the total destruction of the current economic capitalist monster that we're dealing with. I would like nothing more than that. But the problem that keeps running back into my mind here is that these subhumans that we share this planet with, these people that are not awake, these sleepwalkers that just go along with everything, they need a system. So something will take its place, and it might be worse than what we tore down.
Right, right. There's a group of people out there that need a set of controls. There's a group of people out there that they will take advantage of the chaos that comes in that place, at least for the short term. Without something in place, without a plan for themselves, well, I don't see, you know, them having those advantages for very long. And something else will rise up, whether it's petty dictatorships or what have you. Something else rises up. And if you want to call in, the phone number, we've got a half an hour left, 347-989-1371, trying to keep up with what's going on here in the chat room.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the person that's talking right now, the one under the title 9, that's Diavolo from Sin. I don't know if you're familiar with his postings at all, but he's actually a really smart dude. I really enjoy reading a lot of the stuff that he says, and I love the fact that he's got such an anarchist heart.
What he's saying right now, though, is that isn't that the same as we do now? What is it that we're talking about that's the same as what we do now? I understand what you're saying. What steps do you take? That's fine. Okay, so you're saying, you know, we should do something now. What? What should we do differently? And then what do you do once you achieve your goal? What happens once you've achieved that success? So if you want to be the foot soldier out there, you know, going after the collapse of society, I'm more than supportive of that. You know, there are steps that I take. My own comfort level, my way of participating, I have my own things I'm doing to try to hasten that collapse. But I'm also making sure that when that collapse occurs, that I'm as prepared as possible for that collapse, as I'm as prepared as possible to take advantage of the new situation we find ourselves in. And I think that's kind of what we're talking about here. So nobody's talking about being lackadaisical. Nobody's talking about engaging in the system anymore. People are talking about doing something other, the alternative.
Right on. And we're kind of like waiting for him to catch up a little bit, but I'm trying not to let this go too fast along, otherwise it's hard for me to make correlations to what he's actually talking about. For the people who are maybe new to listening to this show or whatever, there's generally like a 5 to 15 second lapse between what's actually going on live and what you're hearing. So it's often very helpful if you know, make sure to put some kind of permanent identifier in there so we know what you're referencing.
Well, when he talks about, and he's mentioning the chat room, the ideas he has are great. I just don't see where the distinction is from what we're talking about. The weak part of this system is the middle class. Disrupt that, the system's going down. Well, by removing yourself from that middle class mentality, by giving up on the middle class values, by pulling yourself out of that and saying, I'm no longer going to participate in the middle class, but I'd rather have no class. I'd rather have low class. I'm not going to be involved in the middle class. That's a step towards disrupting that system. That's a step towards disrupting that middle class. So, again, it's, it, you know, it's
If it's not fast enough for you, well, you know, it's all about what your comfort level is, what it is you're trying to accomplish, and what you think you need to do for yourself. Go ahead.
I was just thinking to myself, you know, the problem comes at the fact that I know just from my conversations with Diablo that he does already have a clan, so to speak. He has a core group of friends that will have his back regardless, and they're all ideologically similar. And so that's a good thing. He can, in fact, go out and affect things and know that he's got a group of people that are going to be supporting him there. But I think to put the idea out there that people should be doing things corrosively and acting on their own, well, it's just a little bit of putting the cart before the horse, and that they should be worried about developing that fallback net first before they go out to do things to corrode. So I guess what I'm saying is, you know, build your clan, build your network, and then from there, you know, take focus and do what you need to do. I mean, that's the way all things have always kind of happened. When I think about, you know, the turn of independence for this country, you know, the Freemasons Lodge was in fact kind of a doubled thing. It was where people came together to talk about what they were going to do, and they planned for it long before they ever, you know, did something like the Tea Party. They had a goal in mind.
Well, and freedom is what we're pursuing. We're pursuing, you know, the ability to be self-determined, to be free. But freedom also means freedom to starve, freedom to fail. So, you know, taking those steps to make sure that you're as prepared as possible for the consequences of your action, I think that's really the necessary first step. I mean, if you're going to burn a bridge down, you want to make sure you've crossed it first.
Right, and you're not going to need to get back across it.
Right.
So I
really think what Diablo's saying, I think we're pretty much on the same page. Is that we're talking about one end of the spectrum, and he's talking about the other end of the spectrum. So it'd be interesting to see, you know, I mean, when he says, you know, this kind of, you know, take away the middle class, well, I appreciate the theory, but it's kind of ambiguous. What specifically are you suggesting? I guess I should go back on Sin and read the different blog posts and everything else to find out, you know, what he and his folks are talking about doing. And we could talk about, and I say, you know, as far as disruption is concerned, as long, especially if it helps you become independent of that system, free of that system, even the smallest things you might do are something. It's a step in the right direction. You don't have to blow something up to be a revolutionary. You could actually just, you know, just talk to people about different ideas, about the alternatives, and that in itself is a revolutionary act.
Well, I agree with that, but there will always need to be those people willing to actually take action, too. We've got to keep that in mind. Talk will
absolutely
only go so far.
Right, right. Absolutely, absolutely. It's you have to be able to take steps. You have to be able to act. It's always, you know, I'm just always curious when I do these things. What's the action? What, you know, what's the plan? What are they engaged in? You know, I guess I can't expect them to come out publicly and say that we're doing this, we're doing that. I would say, you know, non-participation in the financial system would be a non-violent way of taking action against the system. I would say, you know, doing things that you can within your own workplace to change things, to be disruptive or what have you. That would be a non-violent way of dealing with the system. So, again, though, I'm not sure, you know, these idealists come out and they want to, they talk about immediate and drastic action. You know, you should do this, you should do that. Well, you know, let me, you know, read about what you're doing in the paper, and maybe I'll be inspired.
Right, right on. Well, I mean, I don't even think there's a necessity to really call things out in that manner even. I think, you know, first and foremost, self-preservation should always be placed on the top, and where a lot of the things that, you know, he talks about is strike right close to my heart chords. I mean, I am myself, I don't know, maybe it was my Celtic heritage, maybe it's bred into, you know, hundreds of years of you know, people in my bloodline fighting, but I've got this idea of, you know, it's better to fucking die standing up for standing up for yourself than to, you know, buckle or be shackled down by quiet protest. But I realize, on the other hand, my higher mind has kind of, you know, developed a different idea of that, and that, you know, if I die today, who looks after my son, you know?
Right. It's all about level of comfort. So, you know, these people trying to rally the troops to get people to do, you know, whatever it is they think that needs to be done. You know what? Go out and do it yourself. You know, show us the way. Don't just tell us about the way. Show us the way. Now, the other thing is, you know, and when you're talking about retreat, you know, retreat leads to death. I totally agree with that. You're not you don't retreat, but you make sure your position's fortified. You make sure that you are well defended, that you're able to, you know, deal with those attackers. Then you start talking about lashing out. You make sure that you are in a position to attack from. You never attack from a position of weakness. You always attack from a position of strength. And unfortunately, our system has engendered weakness in almost every individual participant in it.
I would agree with that entirely. It's funny because this actually kind of touches back to some of the things that I've been trying to put forth on eminentmind.info. You know, the idea of, you know, being an insidious or, you know, unexpected assailant, you know, the dark horse, so to speak, you know, the person that comes around the corner with a heavy left hand that you weren't expecting. You know, more of the way to be than, you know, pull your sword out and blaze straight down the middle of the field butt fucking naked screaming and hope that nobody mows you down with an AK-47.
Right. And there's something to having an intelligent strategy behind what it is you're doing. Something to being able to act with is, you know, act in a way that is effective, but also act in a way that makes sure that the collateral potential damage that you'd be doing to yourself is minimized.
Right.
So, we're talking about, I think with the ideas we're talking about, we're all on the same page. I think we're just approaching the problem from two different directions.
Right. I see nothing wrong with that, because every direction needs to be evaluated if we're to really make any kind of progress for ourselves.
Well, I'd say you need to engage in both. You need to realize that the system that is around you is not benign; it's malevolent, it's malignant, and it's adversarial. It doesn't encourage your freedom. It doesn't encourage your opportunity. It encourages subservience. It encourages slavery. And anything that wants to enslave you is your enemy. So the more steps you can take to disengage from that system, the more steps you can take to disrupt that system, the better off you'll be. But disengagement, I mean, this is part of the philosophy I think we talk about on Eminent Mind. You can't necessarily rush the prison walls and not expect to be rebuffed, not expect to be, kicked back. The system will take steps to meet drastic action with drastic action. So we're talking about a more subtle lever, a more subtle way of creating that distance, creating that distinction. Eventually leading to an escape. And it means tearing a hole through a wall. It means breaking out. So it may mean violent action at some point. But it means also that, you know, it's a process. It's a measured and carefully thought out strategy. And that's what we're trying to, you know, develop.
Right on. I mean, there's a little bit of wisdom in measuring thrice before you cut, you know?
Right. Risk assessment. I think that's what they call it in business.
Yeah, that's certainly, it's being a calculated risk taker, definitely. I mean, I've found that every person that I've ever met that's been successful in their life through one avenue or the other, in whatever venture they were doing, they were successful because they weren't afraid to take risks, but they were calculated in which risks they would take.
Right, but it wasn't foolhardy rushing into whatever. But the thing that, and again, the system that we're engaged in, what it engenders is the refusal to take risks, to expect guarantees, to expect everything to be handed to you, to expect, you know, that's the mentality that we're seeing among people, this
this handout mentality, this entitlement mentality. There has to be risk taken. You know, but what we're suggesting, you know, be prepared to, you know, get out in the fucking woods and, you know, stay the fuck away from people and things. That's a risk. That's, you know, that's something that could be coming. So definitely you have to have that mentality of being willing to take those risks, whatever those risks might be. But I think, yeah, it's foolish, these people that they end up going to jail for, you know, whatever little cause they're fighting for. So the gesture they've made is, well, they've not only served as an example to the rest of us of what not to do. That's never made sense to me.
Right on. And I'm just trying to think of how I want to express this next part. But, you know, back in the days of swords and crossbows, they used to, you know, nail up entire villages on crosses or hang them off from trees and burned and torched, you know, to incite a kind of a fear. And if you really, you know, if you look at any group that actually had success over the long term, they did things with a kind of a guerrilla tactic to it, which used the same types of psychology that these larger groups understood, you know, like the Roman Empire is one I'm thinking of in particular. You know, they were one of the main people that, you know, just to send a message out, they, you know, would burn the entire village and, you know, hang everybody that was in it. You know, that same kind of mentality could be used on a smaller scale to send a chilling message to them, you know, when they're horrified that there might be a monster out there that's more, I don't know, more agile and stealthy because it's not as robust. And mm-hmm. You know, that kind of thing has a lot more effect, in my opinion, on the overall need to go out and fuck with that group.
Right. I think it's just to be clear, there's certain strategies, certain things that it's just not safe to discuss on a forum like this, in regards to establishing that distinction, establishing that separation between yourself and the system. There are certain things that, you know, like I'm saying, you could do in the workplace. There are certain things that you could do in your neighborhood. There are certain things that you could do to help widen the distance between yourself and the system by, you know, weakening the system that's around you. But it also would not make much sense to talk about those things in this public forum. So, again, I think it's, again, over and over again, it's, you know, we're on the same page. I'm assuming that Diablo, when he's talking about, when he's making these kind of ambiguous overtures towards action, that he must be talking about action that he can't just publicly state. My point is, we get it. We might not be talking about it, but we have the same self-preservation mentality that he has. That there are certain things that you just don't say that you're going to do in an internet forum.
Right on. And it's definitely necessary to be conscious of what those things are, especially if we're, and by we, I mean, you know, the people who are tired of things that the way they are going to actually do anything. You know, it's much better. It's much better to live to, you know, fight several battles than it is to lose in just one.
Right. Right. So the idea of, when you're talking about guerrilla tactics, though, the idea of finding ways to turn the system's resources against itself, to even profit from the use of those resources, you know, making sure that, you know, that you're taking those kinds of steps, those kinds of actions. If you can find a way to take advantage of what you see going on around you, and take advantage of it. If you're in a situation, let's say, this is, I speaking of nonviolent action, all these different welfare programs, all these different things you've got going on, I've always been one in favor of, you know, if you qualify for those systems, those things, there used to be a sense of pride that certain people would have, that they would avoid that welfare check, that they would avoid that handout. Now the way things are going, I actively encourage people, if you qualify for that shit, go get it. Go get as much of it as you possibly can, because you've been paying into it, and the more of it you have, if you're one of us, if you have this ideology, the more you're able to get for yourself,
without having to expend your resources to get it. And I say, go get that fucking shit. And, you know, they talk about FEMA running out of money. They talk about unemployment benefits running out and everything else. They talk about, you know, the faster that shit happens, well, then the faster the whole thing collapses. And
right.
The better off we'll be.
Right on, right on. Shit, man. 10 minutes left in the show. I'm scratching my head. We've been all over the place tonight, like we said we were going to be. I think it's definitely necessary that anybody who's really concerned about the events of things take some kind of hand-to-hand combat course. You know, nothing too extensive that you're going to have to spend years mastering, but just learning, you know, a certain set of techniques that might help you in defending yourself, or, you know, might further your ability to protect yourself. And in the case that this system does come apart faster than you can separate yourself from it, it would be a good idea.
Right. A simple street fighting course, a women's self-defense course, you know, anything like that. Any knowledge you have that you can use to your advantage is always going to be good knowledge. I think also that, while you're taking steps to prepare, taking steps to, in every way possible, in any way you can think of, you know, start thinking outside the box. You know, turn off the televisions, disengage from social, you know, the different media that's provided to the masses and everything else, and start engaging the people around you. When you're talking about taking action, when you're talking about taking steps to do something, part of that, I think, involves in, you know, getting people in that you are concerned about, that you're invested in, and working with them so that, you know, it's not only you taking steps, but it's them taking steps and making sure that you're doing as much as possible with the people that you care about. Because you don't want to find yourself, you know, again, in that situation where you're alone, where you're, you know, you're totally relying on whatever it is you've got going. And even though you might be totally prepared, an overwhelming force will still take you out.
Right on. Right on. Couple of things, I guess, I wanted to make mention of. I was for a while kind of making it a habit to mention this other place for people to check out, but there's a lot of really kind of good ideas being talked about on the L316 website, still to this day. You know, a lot of ways that people are hypothetically doing things to make little bits of damage happen to the system. Also, I think that they're better served, being the set of minds that is there on the L316 website. They're better served to maybe come up with other little ideas to help you take advantage of, you know, an opportunity that might be growing right now that you're not quite sure how to seize on. I know eventually I plan for Eminent Mind to have that kind of support to it too, but I think that we're still kind of working to develop our ideology.
Right on, right on. Yeah, I definitely recommend checking that out. I recommend a lot of the, you know, there's a lot of the ONA information that's worth looking into, worth reading. I also look at a lot of the activity going on with Anonymous, what they're doing, what they're about, the different ideas they're talking about, the different groups within Anonymous, similar in mentality and everything. And then, but the key of it all is not just to read about it, it's not just to talk about it, it's to implement it. And again, it doesn't matter, in my opinion, it doesn't matter what it is you're doing. As long as you're doing something, as long as you're taking whatever small step you take is a step in the right direction.
Right on. Right on. I mean, to an extent, I don't think that making it a habit to run every stop sign you cross is really going to, you know, benefit some kind of huge fuck you to the system. But, you know, you might take out a few people in the process, but that'd be about it.
Yeah, I don't think it makes sense to go out and try to break every law in the book or whatever, willy nilly, you know. Let's think about it. Let's talk about that real quick. Action without purpose, action without direction, without thought is wasted action.
Absolutely, it's sleeping action still. in my opinion, you know, these people are still not, quote unquote, awake. They're not aware of what's actually going on. If they don't have the ability to kind of put foresight to what they're doing, then it's still just reactive and not really beneficial for themselves at all.
Right on, right. And I think this is something that, you know, we're developing on Eminent Mind, this idea that, you know, there's a philosophy about being aware, about being cognizant, about really getting into, you know, who it is you are and developing a, not developing a sense of self, but really discovering that self without the trappings that the system has placed on you, without the value systems that have been kind of, you know, forced on you or put on you based on your culture and your ethnicity and your nationality and everything. Really getting down to some core essential being has led a lot to, you know, what it is we're talking about. You know, we're seeing this thing as corrupt. We're seeing it as malignant. And, you know, we want to make sure we're, you know, putting some distance between ourselves and it and making sure that it goes away so that, and, you know, hopefully whatever replaces it, because, again, something will rise up and replace it, has that same ideology, has that same encouragement for self-determination and awareness.
Right. We can only hope, but you know me, I'm an eternal pessimist in a way, so I don't see that as ever being the case. I don't think that, my problem really lies here, that the sleeping man, this mindless man, as I've come to call them, they dominated the world. They are the superior of our species. The man who thinks for himself is often isolated and you know, left alone to kind of negotiate through this. You either get good at playing their game or, you know, you become a vagrant, you know. I mean, you talk about these folks that have PhDs choosing vagrancy as their lifestyle. You know, that's because they couldn't get good at the game. So, you know, you kind of have this choice. You can clan together, like I keep saying, or, you know, keep trying to go at it the way that you are and know that, you know, when the shit does hit the fan, not everybody around you is going to be trustworthy. I mean, I can't think of how many cases. One in particular I'm thinking of, Benedict Arnold, during the Revolutionary War. There were a lot of redcoats that, you know, disguised themselves as the common man.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of key to where we're moving with this, is that if the shit were to hit the fan right now, then you've got all these sleeping machines suddenly cut loose. They don't have any controls anymore. The governors that are in place that have been developed by the system to keep them in line go away, and they become very, very dangerous to everyone around them, including themselves. So before, you know, the total collapse of the system occurs, I want to make sure that there's, you know, that distance between myself and my family and those kinds of people. So I think that's what we're working towards. But always at the forefront of our mind is that this thing is collapsing. And in many ways, the faster it collapses, the faster it moves out of the way, the faster then we're going to actually see some progression.
Right on. Right on. Well, we made it through another 2 hours, dude. And I'd say I only had to derail it a couple of times, so I didn't do too bad.
Right on.
But I was making a mental effort not to say the word the whole time. So.
Yeah. You did a really good job then.
I try, man. That's actually a really kind of neat little wisdom to that. That's a real nice little thing that you put together there. So, yeah, I don't know. Maybe we'll talk about that another time.
Right on. All right, so I guess we're out. We'll see you guys next Sunday.
Sounds good, dude.
Later.
Thank you for for listening to the Ooze. Opinions expressed by our guests or callers do not necessarily represent the opinions held by TC, Zach, Jason, Matt, or any other institution represented by them. If you have been offended by the production of this show, we are sorry, but as the old expression goes, tough luck. Special thanks to Dad, the Rocky DeRoma, for his contribution to this outro. The Ooze is the Creative Oddity Studios product and is presented by Titanic International Network as its official Blog Talk radio show. Why waste your time with those other guys?